Welcome. My name is Greg Epstein. I'm the humanist chaplain of Harvard University. I'm happy to be co-sponsoring this event, our humanist chaplaincy at Harvard, along with the primary sponsors, the Harvard Secular Society, and also the Secular Student Alliance, which is a national group, and the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which is a national group. The Secular Student Alliance helped provide funding to allow us to have Dan Barker with us today, and the Intercollegiate Institute Studies Institute provided funding to allow us to have Dinesh D'Souza with us today. We're very, very happy that both of those groups could be with us. Now, we're here for this debate in the middle of, obviously, election season, presidential debate season. And in fact, don't worry, we timed it perfectly so that we'll have this done for you just at the time when any meaningful results are coming in. So we prevented you from having to sit by your radios, you know, and wait. This will really work it out well for you. It's also, however, hockey season. It's very important. Why? Because, you know the old joke, I went to the fight and a hockey game broke out? Well, we were thinking about what kind of debate we wanted to have tonight, and we thought, well, maybe if people could come to a debate about atheism and Christianity, and a conversation could break out. Maybe, just maybe, that would be a model worth adopting for us. We have with us here today two of the most prominent spokespeople for their understanding of atheism and Christianity, Dinesh D'Souza. And what can one say, by the way, about Dinesh D'Souza and Dan Barker? Dan introduced himself. Dinesh is going to introduce himself. I would just say these are both very, very distinguished individuals, very compelling individuals, very controversial individuals. I hope you visit their websites, DineshD'Souza.com. Dan Barker, you can go to FFRF, that's Freedom From Religion Foundation.org. And we're really happy to have them with us. We want to point out again that this is a student-moderated debate. I'm just happy to share a couple jokes with you and then turn it over to my very capable students who were going to be asking all the questions themselves. They wrote all the questions themselves. There's an opportunity for you to chime in and to contribute your own questions. But we were really excited that this is a student-driven debate. It's a little bit non-traditional, probably fitting for a presidential election season in which some of the debates have been non-traditional as well. But we hope you enjoy it. And again, if you see something that you think is missing, if you see something that you wish could have been a little different, could have been a little bit more to your liking, we encourage you to get involved, help out, become part of the Harvard Secular Society, or get involved with one of our related organizations, whether it's the Secular Student Alliance, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, or any other of the institutions that are the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, what have you. Get involved. We can use your help. We're growing a community here. In our case, we're growing a community for humanists, atheists, agnostics, and the non-religious at Harvard and beyond, and we would love to have your support. And I'm sure that Dinesh can recommend any number of excellent institutions, including we have with us the first questioner from the audience will be a guest from the Harvard Radcliffe Christian Fellowship. So, there you have it. And now I'm very proud to turn it over again to my students from the Harvard Secular Society, to Dan Barker, and to Dinesh D'Souza. Please join us and introduce yourself, and thank you for coming.
Mr. Barker, would you like to give your opening statement?
Okay, yeah.
Sure. Just as a brief introduction, Mr. Barker is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest atheist organization, and a reformed minister. I guess reformed is the word.
Reformed. Thank you, Dan. Thank you all for coming. Good evening. Whoa! It happened last night and it's happening again here. You know, I used to be a preacher, and every time I get back in a pulpit in front of a church, I have all these feelings that come over me again. And I'm standing here with this almost irresistible urge to take up a collection. But I'll try to resist the urge. You know, I was a pastor for 19 years. I preached. I was a missionary. I was an evangelist. I was a Christian songwriter. I was a true believer. I really believed it. If I was not a true believer, nobody is a true believer. Today I'm an atheist. I don't speak for all atheists. An atheist is a person who lacks a belief in a God. I'm an atheist because there's no evidence for a God. If there were, by now somebody should have won the Nobel Prize for bringing it forth and showing us this. I'm an atheist because there's no coherent definition of a spiritual God. I'm an atheist because there's no agreement among believers as to the nature or the moral principles of this God they say they believe in. I'm an atheist because there's no good argument for a God, and we've seen them and we've beat them to death. I'm an atheist because there's no good replies to the positive arguments against a God. For example, the problem of evil. All you have to do is walk into any children's hospital and you know there is no God. Those families desperately praying for their children who are in pain and who die. A loving God, at least there's no loving God who would allow something like that to happen. And I'm an atheist because there's no need for a belief in a God. Millions of people on this continent around the world live happy lives, productive lives, moral lives, loving lives, without belief in a supernatural being. We're just fine. Atheism is reasonable. It's the lack of a belief in a God or gods. But is atheism better than Christianity, which is our debate tonight? Well, yes, for the very simple reason that Christianity is not true. I used to preach the claims of Christianity. I used to stand in the pulpit and believe them with all my heart. But when I scratched beneath the surface and started to study the evidences and the reasonings and the documents and the claims, I reluctantly discovered that what I was preaching is simply not true. That's the basic question that should be asked of any religion. Not is it useful, but is it true? Atheism is not a moral system, but then neither is Christianity. Christianity is a salvation system. There are many wonderful Christians in the world. I know many of them. I work with a lot of them. There are many horrible Christians in the world. We all know that. The same is true of atheists. There are many wonderful atheists in the world who went down to help during Hurricane Katrina, who give their lives, who sacrifice their time and the energy without any hope of a future reward. There are also many horrible atheists in the world. Stalin was a horrible atheist, a horrible human being. Hitler was a horrible Christian. People should be judged not by their beliefs. People should be judged by their actions. Christians are followers of Christ. That's what a Christian is. Here are some of the moral teachings of Jesus. Even though Christians sing about peace on earth at Easter time, at Christmas time, Jesus said, "Think not that I came to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword." He threatened physical violence and torture with this hell that his Father created. He said, "If you don't hate your family, you cannot be my disciple." He never married. He never fathered children. He never denounced slavery. He incorporated it into his parables as if it were the most natural order. In fact, he said some slaves will be beaten harder than others because they knew better. He did nothing to alleviate poverty. He said, "The poor you have with you always." He said, "If you do something wrong with your eye or hand, cut it off." He said this in a sexual context. Marrying a divorced woman is committing adultery. Other moral advice that he gave us, this Christ that Christians follow: don't plan for the future. Don't save money. Don't become wealthy. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Although he did not do this himself. Don't work to obtain food. Don't have sexual urges, he said. Let everybody know that you are better than the rest of the world. If someone steals from you, don't try to get it back, Jesus said. If someone hits you, don't defend yourself. Invite them to do it again, Jesus said. If you lose a lawsuit, pay more than the judgment. If anyone asks you for anything, give it to them without question. What kind of car do you drive, Dinesh? Maybe I'll put you to the test tonight and see if you believe what Jesus says. Jesus did give some good moral teachings. It would be a true miracle if he didn't, but most of them were borrowed. The golden rule was borrowed. It's a good idea. Love your neighbor, of course, is not a bad idea, but these are things that we can figure out on our own without Christianity. On balance, the moral teachings of the founder of Christianity are inferior and they are dangerous. It's to the credit of most Christians, I think, that they have risen above their brutal Bible. They are smarter than Jesus. They are kinder than God. Since Christianity is a salvation system and there's no such thing as sin, then we don't need it. Even Jesus is quoted as saying, "They who are healthy don't need the doctor. Only they who are sick," in Matthew 9:12. We atheists don't consider ourselves sick. Atheism is a wellness of mind, and I think it's a kind of a courage of conviction in a predominantly religious culture that makes it possible for us to see the world as it really is, which is our best shot at creating solutions that are truly relevant. Think about this: if salvation is the cure, then atheism is the prevention.
Thank you very much. I am delighted and honored to be here. I want to thank the Harvard Secular Society. I want to thank Dan Barker for being here. Since we are in this hallowed setting, if in the middle of the debate a big hole opens up and the three of them disappear and I'm the only guy left standing up here, I think you'll understand. I found it interesting to hear Dan introduce himself. He was a preacher for many years. I think by his own account, he was talking nonsense for many years. I'm here to show that he's still talking nonsense. But I look forward to an engaged dialogue. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in Bombay, India. And I was, oddly enough, for that part of the world, born Christian. I'm from a part of India in the south called Goa, which about 300 or 400 years ago was visited by Portuguese missionaries. The missionaries came with a Bible in one hand and a sword in the other. It was called the Portuguese Inquisition. They were very persuasive. My ancestors saw the light and converted to Christianity. Actually, in conversations with my grandfather, the story is a little more complicated than that. It's true. The Portuguese came bearing, if you will, Christianity at the point of a bayonet. But they also found themselves remarkably successful in drawing hordes of people to Christianity. By the time they left in their three colonies, the entire populations were Christian. One reason for this, by the way, historians note, is because the low-caste Hindus didn't have to be subjected to the sword. They fled very quickly, very willingly, into the arms of the missionaries. Not because, by the way, the missionaries were very nice guys. Rather, it was because they heard something in Christianity that they had never heard before. You see, in the Hindu caste system, you're a frog. If you're at one of the bottom rungs of the ladder, there's really no place to go. No amount of merit can move you up the ladder. And your children and their children are also consigned to the same bottom rung. The only way to move up is to move out. This is, by the way, why one in every six Hindus became a Muslim. It's also why a lot of Hindus rushed into the arms of Christianity. They found in the Christian idea of universal brotherhood something that was not there before. This was not an ideal universally implemented. It was the mere articulation of it. So, there we are. That's how I became a Christian birth. But I became, one may say, a bad Christian, or actually more precisely, a stupid Christian. Why? Because most of us learn our religious beliefs when we're very young. I learned mine at my parents' knee when I was 5 or 8, 10 years old. Now, this is not Christianity. This is what I want to call crayon Christianity. The story of the big man with the Santa Claus beard and so on. And when I came to America as an exchange student at the age of 16, when I found myself as a freshman on the Dartmouth campus up the road in Hanover, at the age of 17, I found those Christian beliefs under withering attack. This happens to all young people on campus. Secularism is now firmly rooted. It is, in fact, the orthodoxy of Harvard. It is, in fact, the entrenched ideology of intelligentsia. And so I was battered with these kinds of questions. Not that these questions don't have answers, but I didn't know what those answers were. And so I found myself pulling away from my Christian beliefs. In a certain sense, I flung myself into political conservatism. I saw it as a more empirical, a more anchored, a more realistic, a more tough-minded way to see the world. It's only a little bit later in adult life, as a result of thinking, reflecting, I realized that there is a whole other Christianity. Let's call it adult or mature Christianity, very different from the Christianity I learned when I was 9. That Christianity is fully capable of withstanding the barbs and arrows, not only of the new atheists, the so-called new atheists out there, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and so on. They are just the Lilliputian shadows of the great atheists of the 19th century and early 20th century, figures like Nietzsche and Heidegger and Bertrand Russell and Sigmund Freud. It is ultimately those atheists who need to be answered. And in some ways, I'll be addressing those arguments as well tonight. But what I'm saying is, I would like to urge you, many of us feel like we've gone through all this, we've seen it, we've come out of the other end jaded and sophisticated. But no, this sophistication in a sense conceals its own built-in prejudices. So what I'm going to show today, if I have a chance, this is a question-driven format, I'm going to show, number one, there are very good reasons to believe in God. God is true and Christianity is true. I'm going to show that the so-called conflict between science and religion is completely bogus. I'm going to show that science itself is based on articles of faith. I'm going to show that morality is objective and has its roots in a transcendent creator. I'm going to show that atheism, not religion, is responsible for the mass murders of history. I'm going to show all this and more if given the opportunity. Ultimately, I want you to see theism. I want you to see transcendence. I want you to see Christianity in something of a new light. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Before we begin, I'm just going to outline some of the rules of the debate. Several of my colleagues in the Harvard Secular Society will be asking the questions. There will be four sections of questions, theology, ethics, politics, and pluralism. For each question, we will allow 2 minutes for the person to answer. Some of the questions will be addressed to both, and some will be addressed to only one of the speakers. For those that are addressed to only one of the speakers, at my discretion, I will allow a 90-second response from the other speaker and potentially a 45-second response from the original speaker to that. After this, at the end of each section, we will allow each speaker to ask one question of the other speaker. After this, we will move on to the audience question and answer period of the debate. We will allow 2 minutes for each answer. There will be no follow-up questions for those. And finally, we will allow 3-minute closing speeches, depending on the time. With that, Lewis Ward, and he will be asking questions on theology.
All right, thank you. To begin, we will have a question about science and religion. This is a question for both Mr. Barker and Mr. D'Souza. Could you each please explain your view of the ideal relationship between science and religion? To what extent should each be influenced by the other? Mr. Barker, if you could please go first, followed by Mr. D'Souza.
Religion, especially Christianity, has an epistemology that not only includes but requires faith. In the Bible, in Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews said, "He who comes to God must believe that he exists." The epistemology of Christianity and many religions is a faith way of knowing what is true or false. Science rejects faith as a valid tool of knowledge. Faith might have some uses as a temporary placeholder or whatever, but as a tool of knowledge, faith is useless. If an assertion has to be accepted by faith, then there's an admission that that assertion cannot be accepted on its own merits. When you know something is true, it's because it's been tested, it's been repeated, it's falsifiable in principle, it is internally coherent and it's logical, it's free of non sequiturs, and it is honestly done, free of any agenda or motivation, like religious motivations, like loyalty. So the science and religion that requires faith, such as Christianity, are incompatible. On the other hand, Christianity does make claims about the universe, that makes claims that there is this mind-being complex creature up there, and if that claim were true, that claim would be accessible to science. And as many people, including Dawkins, point out, a universe with a being like that in it would be a different kind of universe than one without it. So the factual claims of Christianity, if they are free from faith, are subject to scientific scrutiny. And when you look at them with the tools of science, you see that these they do not withhold. The level of confidence for the religious claims, the resurrection of Jesus or the existence of God or so on, are so low that they can be virtually ignored.
Let's explore first if science and religion are incompatible, if there's some kind of a war between the two. If you were to make a list of the greatest scientists of the past 300 years or 500 years, a list that would surely include Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Boyle, Pascal, Gassendi, Rutherford, Newton, Einstein, and so on, make a list and look at it. You will notice that virtually every name on this list is in fact a believer in God, and the vast, vast majority are in fact Christians. So, here you have people of the caliber of Copernicus and Newton. They did not see any conflict between science and religion. In fact, they saw their work as revealing the handiwork of God in the universe. The greatest scientists have not seen this conflict. I'll take their word over an embittered former preacher. What about the idea that science is based on evidence, but religion is based on faith? I want to show that science is based on three faith-based propositions that can in no way be substantiated by evidence. Number one, the idea that the universe is rational. Now, frankly, you and I can be rational because we possess a brain. The universe has no brain. How can a universe be rational? Modern science is based on the assumption that it is. Second, the universe obeys laws. Now, you and I can obey laws. We are purposeful, intentional agents. If we're driving on a side street, we see a stop sign, we can stop. The universe is an inanimate object. How does the electron know what to do? We're talking about some very complex laws. Newton's laws, Kepler's laws, Einstein's E equals MC squared. Science is based on the faith-based assumption of a lawful universe. And third, there is the assumption that the rationality of the world out there is mirrored in the rationality of our own heads. Now think about this. This is the strangest fact of all. Your brain is made up of atoms and molecules and neurons and circuits. So why should the worrying that's going on in here match the rationality of the world out there? What is the reason? There is no reason. Now, if you are a believer, all of this makes sense. We believe that God is omniscient. He made us rational universe. God is a lawgiver. He gave us the Ten Commandments, the moral law. He gave us the physical law, the laws of nature. And we are created in the image of God, and so we have within us a spark of that divine rationality. No wonder we can apprehend the world out there. So if you're a theist, all of this makes sense. But if you're an atheist, you've got to take it 100% on faith. So the idea that science eschews faith is complete nonsense. Science, not only in its origins, but up to today, is based on these three faith-based propositions, which are a direct legacy of Christian theology.
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Lewis, do you have a next question?
Do we have a chance for a rebuttal on these?
On the questions that are addressed to both, I would prefer not to do rebuttals. But we may change that depending on the amount of time. Yes, so next question.
All right, next we have a question for Mr. D'Souza. Most religions have a scripture that they claim to be the word of God, so how can you feel confident that yours is the one that's truly divinely inspired?
I see religions as a human effort to apprehend the divine. In this sense, the presence of the divine, the transcendent God, can be defended and to a large degree known by reason, what Kant called religion within the limits of reason alone. Now, religion ultimately is based on two dimensions. You may say the dimension of reason and the dimension of revelation. It is impossible to use reason to adjudicate between competing revelations. In that sense, I have no way of saying that Christianity is, in its revelation, better or truer than other religions. I can't say that based on reason. In fact, when the end of the world comes, I guess we'll know. If the phone call turns out to be from Salt Lake City, big surprise to all of us, won't it be? Look, I want to make a little different point. The way I look at it is somewhat different. I see religion as an effort to bridge the gap. We all sense in our life a chasm between the way we are and, you might say, the way we should be. We sense a chasm between our life as it is and perfection.
And by perfection, what I mean is perfect beauty, perfect goodness, perfect truth, and so on. So here is this huge divide. Religion is an effort to try to bridge that. And I see the major Abrahamic religions, particularly, by the way, Judaism and Islam, as a way to construct a ladder. A human ladder to God. If you follow these codes, these commandments, these dietary regulations, pray 5 times a day, go to Mecca, you're going to move up the rungs of the ladder. Eastern religions similarly view the problem as the self, and if you can extinguish the self, you'll achieve in some senses what the Buddhists call nirvana. Now Christianity is based on the premise that this divide, this chasm is so big that no human effort will ever bridge it. And therefore the only way to bridge it, if it is going to be bridged, is God must in some sense descend down, He must condescend to the human level. And this is what I see in the incarnation of Christ. In a sense, God, if you will, leaning down and closing this gap. And I think, speaking anthropologically, speaking on pure reason, looking at the world as it is, this seems to me a more realistic assessment of the way it's going to have to happen. I don't see a way for us. We are made, Immanuel Kant said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. I don't think man on his own can make his way to God. God has to make his way to man. For these reasons, quite apart from whether the Bible is true as opposed to the Quran, I don't want to get into that kind of hocus-pocus debate. I want to debate today not by quoting the Bible, not by flinging scriptural verses. I want to debate based on history and philosophy and science, the same rational evidence that the atheists appeal to. My goal is ultimately to defeat atheism on its own ground.
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Brock, you have 90 seconds to respond.
Well, you did not answer the question. And Dinesh is obviously a very kind and very smart individual. And I admire someone like him. But tonight, all he's doing is equivocating. I think you can see that. No scientists say that the universe is rational. It is only a mind that can be rational. The universe is just what it is. The universe is not rational. It might conform to rational patterns in our minds, but it's an equivocation of the word rational to say that since we are rational, the universe is rational. You're also making a philosophy 101 mistake when you talk about the laws of nature are obeyed. The laws of nature are not prescriptive laws, they are descriptive laws. Descriptive laws describe how things in fact actually work. Prescriptive laws, like speed limits and that, the human laws, are what we choose to obey or not obey, and we are fine. So you're mixing apples and oranges, you are equivocating, you are fudging your answers, trying to make a rhetorical point, and that is dishonest.
Thank you. I do ask, in the interest of moving the debate along, that both speakers try to focus on the question at hand, and so that we can, you know, move through the topic areas. Mr. D'Souza, you have 45 seconds to respond.
Well, it's difficult for me to rebut the topic at hand since he addressed a different topic, so I'm going to, in this one case,
address
his...
Can I have a point of order?
Yes, sir.
Wasn't the question addressed to him and he answered it and then I had a rebuttal?
Yes.
So why is he rebutting my rebuttal?
Because... in particular, I think your rebuttal was responding to the original question, the first question that he was asked.
But I responded by pointing out that
right.
He did not answer. So why does he have a chance to rebut my rebuttal?
Oh, sorry. The way we're doing it is 2 minutes for the speaker, 90 seconds for the other speaker, and then 45 seconds response to the response.
Is that true? Okay.
So
I think he's trying to say you cheated.
Sorry.
I apologize. I misunderstood.
Oh, No. No problem at all. Sorry, if I didn't make the rules clear, there will be some back and forth during this debate, and there will be responses to responses that will be 45 seconds. So, Mr. D'Souza, you have 45 seconds.
We had a very interesting admission a moment ago. In a sense, most scientists, when they do their work, they believe they're actually describing a universe out there that is distinct, if you will, from us. A universe, if you will, that has its own separate identity, that operates, if you will, according to its own laws and rules. The great physicist Eugene Wigner wrote an essay a couple of decades ago called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. And he said, in a sense, it's rather odd that matter is so unbelievably well behaved. For example, if we were to measure the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second in a vacuum, measure it again, it's the same speed. And we presume that if you go to a star 5 light years away, light travels at the same speed over there. Do we know it? No. The science of evidence that is the case? No. We assume it's the case. Why? Because we assume that light travels everywhere in a vacuum at that same speed. Now, Dan Barker, if you will, is changing the rules by saying, you know what? I don't even know if there is such a thing as light. These rules are not out there. They are in my head. Now, I want to emphasize this because I'm going to argue that if that is true, the experience of God, whether or not He's out there, is as real a moral experience as anything else that we can see in the world.
All right, and if thank we're you, only, Susan, I'm sorry, I have to cut
and
you
I'll come back to this a little bit later.
All right. Lewis, the next question?
Yes, next we have a question for Mr. Barker. You have rejected Christian theology, but how do you throw out the possibility of any other concept of God?
Yes. General atheism with a lowercase a, some call it soft atheism, some call it negative atheism, which describes all atheists, is simply the absence of a belief in a God or gods. It's a lack of a belief. Atheism, as such, is not a positive statement. It's not a belief or a claim. It's just simply the lack of a belief. Most of us here are atheists regarding, well, what day of the week is it today? Tuesday, the Norse god too. Probably no one here believes in that god. You lack a belief in that god. You are atheistic regarding that god. However, many of us atheists, a subset of atheism might be capital A atheists, positive atheists you might say, when it comes to a particular definition of a god. When it comes to the Christian god, the god of the Bible, I am a capital A positive atheist. Not only do I say that god does not exist, that god cannot exist. I'm proud to say that I possess not only a belief, but a knowledge that that God does not exist. However, there's an infinite number of possible definitions of a God. Maybe the Muslim Allah God who doesn't have children. Maybe that's the true God, you know. Maybe, and you could keep inventing definitions. We spend our whole life disproving all these definitions. So on those other gods, I'm a lowercase a atheist, which is the same as agnosticism. You can be an agnostic atheist or an agnostic theist. Either way, if you can't say yes to the question, do you have a belief in a God, you are an atheist by definition. So I'm open. Show me the evidence. Where's the beef? You know, if there's anything that's obvious, is that the evidence for God is not obvious. We're still having debates after all these centuries. Dinesh still agrees to debate a topic which is debatable. If there is a God, it shouldn't be a debatable question about His existence. So I'm open-minded, and even if someone were to present convincing evidence for the existence of the Christian God, I would happily change my mind. I'm not stupid. I'm not angry. I want to know what is true. If you present the evidence to me, I've already demonstrated at least once that I am capable and flexible enough to change my mind. I will do it again. But at this point, the Christian God cannot and does not exist. Other gods may or may not. And, you know, I'd like to go up and shake their hands if they're there, if somebody would show me something about them.
Hey, thank you. Ms. Souza, you have 90 seconds to respond.
We all don't believe in certain things. One may say fanciful things, unicorns and the like. Usually if we don't believe in those things, we just go about our lives as if those things don't exist. For example, I don't believe in unicorns, but you'll notice I haven't written any books. Unicorns are not great. The end of unicorns. The unicorn delusion. Or to take Dan Barker's book, Losing Faith in Unicorns. This tells me that something more is going on. Christopher Hitchens, in one of his statements, says, I'm not an atheist, I'm an anti-theist. I think what he's trying to say is, it's not that I don't believe in God, I hate God. And he says, I don't want to go to heaven. If there's such a place, count me out. With Dan Barker, I think we see a similar dogmatism. If he were to say, look, I'm open, I used to be overconfident, I was a little fanatical in my beliefs then, but I'm really open-minded now. But I suggest he is equally fanatical now. To the point where on something where none of us know, I fully confess that on the grounds of reason alone, I too am an agnostic. And by an agnostic, what I mean is an agnostic is someone who doesn't know. I believe, but I don't know. There's a difference between belief and knowledge, by the way. For example, I wouldn't say I believe in my brother. I know the guy. We believe in something if we don't know. In this sense, Dan Barker and I are in the same position. Here's the difference. I admit it. He won't. He pretends as if his position is made based on reason. He pretends that not only does, that of all the gods out there, he's open to all of them, except one. He has positive knowledge that this one God not only does not exist, but cannot exist.
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Barker, you have 45 seconds to respond.
Thank you. The God of Christianity is defined in mutually exclusive terms. For example, free will and omniscience. A being who is both free will and omniscient cannot exist. It'd be like arguing, does a married bachelor exist? It's a stupid debate. Married bachelors don't exist because they cannot exist. The Christian God is defined in many of these terms that cancel each other out and make such a being impossible. Many theologians, you are aware of the fact, have had to tinker with their definition of God. For example, he can't be all benevolent, so they have to have a different type of a God if you try to put them all together. That's why I can say with confidence that the Christian God not only does not exist, but cannot exist. And by the way, if Christianity was not causing so many problems in this country, violating separation of church and state, butting into everybody's business, I'd be happy to leave it alone. I wouldn't write books about it. Atheists are responding to the onslaught of attack by you over-eager Christians butting into our lives. We have no choice but to defend ourselves against the proselytizing of Christianity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barker. Lewis, if you have one more question.
Yes, I have one more question for both debaters. What would have to happen for you to reverse your view on the existence of God? Mr. D'Souza first, please.
I think that a question that every believer has to face is, can you envision circumstances in which you would become an atheist? And I certainly can. In fact, in some senses, the process has already happened to me once. When I was in college, I imported to Dartmouth Christian beliefs. I was hit with a bunch of different questions. How can are you telling me you believe someone was born of a virgin, walked on the ocean, brought dead people back to life? Are you nuts? We're living in the 20th century, now the 21st century. And don't you believe science operates according to invarying laws? Or, how do you know your religion is true? If you were born in Saudi Arabia, wouldn't you be a Muslim? Now, my point is, I wanted to believe, but my brain was getting in the way. And so, as a result, I did what a lot of Christians will do in that circumstances. Our allegiance ultimately is to truth. It's not that we believe just because it consoles us when we want to believe. Ultimately, our fidelity is to truth. And so it was that fidelity imbibed in the atmosphere of critical learning that pulled me away from religion. Now, it is that same atmosphere of critical questioning that caused me to turn, you might say, my skeptical mind onto skepticism itself, to realize that there are hidden metaphysical assumptions buried underneath atheism which are rarely acknowledged. That once you acknowledge them, the debate becomes seen in a completely new light. So I, in a sense, rediscovered in later life a Christianity that seemed to me more reasonable, make more sense of the world, and not suffer from the kind of narrow-mindedness. See, in some ways, every believer can envision what it's like to be an atheist. Every believer is an atheist with regard to other religions. In some senses, though, the problem I think atheists have is, it is for them, in a sense, they cannot take account of genuine belief. The vast majority of people in the world are believers, and the atheists have got to say, you people are seeing UFOs. You people are suffering from delusions. What? 95% of people on the planet are so stupid that they are suffering from universal delusions on a daily basis? Let's have a little more respect for human intelligence, and let's have a little more respect for human experience. This is the kind of dogmatic atheism that drives me nuts.
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Barker, same question.
Well, I will actually answer the question. Atheism is falsifiable. I don't think theism is falsifiable in principle. If Jesus were to materialize here on this stage out of thin air, and we caught it on videotape, and you all testified to it, and if he were to give us the exact geographic coordinates in the Holy Land where the Ark of the Covenant is buried, 14.5 feet underground, and we were to go to that spot and dig up the tablets on which the Ten Commandments were actually written, if that were to happen, then I would change my mind. I would say, wow, that I was wrong. If the Bible says, all things whatsoever you shall ask in prayer believing, you shall receive. So ask God to give you a prophecy. For example, if God were to tell you that tomorrow at 2:30, a meteorite from the northeast coming down at 85 degrees angle would puncture this building, would go right through this podium and end 12 and a half feet below the basement, composed of 70% iron, composed of what? So 20% nickel and 3% iridium and so on. And if that actually happened, as your God supposedly was able to do, I would change my mind and I would say, Dinesh, you were right. We could all think of a number of things that would falsify atheism. I would happily change my mind if you would give me evidence. Like, if you would prove to me that Jesus was telling the truth when he said, all things whatsoever you ask in prayer believing, you shall receive. The prayer of faith will heal the sick. The Bible is very clear about those things. So it's perfectly falsifiable, and that's what makes atheism stronger. The failure to falsify a statement is what actually strengthens the truth claims of a statement. So far, we haven't heard anything that would even in principle falsify Dinesh's claim that a God exists.
Thank you. While there'll be no responses to this, each debater will now have the opportunity to ask the other one a question. Mr. Susan, do you have a question you'd like to ask?
Now, the question, do I get to, can I cross-examine him a little bit?
No, just one question, please, no follow-ups.
All right. Let me put it this way. I'm going to answer his question and frame it in the form of a question. The Bible makes a rather startling statement, which in fact flies in the face of all empirical evidence. The universe had a beginning. Not only the universe at the beginning, but a God who is outside of space and time created not only the universe, but space and time. Space and time had a beginning. An astounding thought. Because no matter how far back you go in time, you can always think about the day before, the year before. Today, if you go into an introductory physics class at Harvard, you will learn as a direct consequence of the Big Bang that, in fact, the universe did have a beginning. And equally startling, not only did all of matter have a beginning, space and time also had a beginning. So in some senses, this is something rather remarkable. Modern science has 2,000 years later come to agree with a bunch of relatively moderately educated fellows who said 2,000 years ago, not based on science, based upon God told me, that this universe of ours had a beginning. So here's my question to Dan Barker. Not the vindication of God, but rather this. Where did the universe come from? If all things that have a beginning, if all material objects that have a beginning must have a cause, what is the cause for which the universe is the effect?
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. I'd like to also remind the debaters that a question is a short, inquisitive statement with a question mark at the end. Mr. Barker, you have 2 minutes. Sorry.
We know that space and time came into existence at the beginning of the universe. And that the words that you just used, the word where and cause, those are spatial-temporal words. Those are concepts that can only function within space-time. So asking what is the beginning of time is a meaningless question. It's like asking, you know, what is the beginning of the Earth? You could say, if you go up to the latitudes up to zero, you get to the North Pole. What is north of the North Pole? That's a meaningless question. To ask what happened before time is a meaningless question. To ask what is the cause of something outside of the space-time dimension in which causality is even possible is a meaningless question. To ask what caused cause is a meaningless question. Again, you're mixing logical spheres here. How can a being exist outside of time? A being, by definition, occupies space and time. That's what a being is. It seems to me you're equivocating again. It's like Bill Clinton, what's the definition of is, you know? To exist means to exist within space and time. Time is not a thing that you can be outside of. Time is a dimension. Where does it start? Where does it end? How do you know you're outside? I guess I would reply with a question to you. If God is outside of time, I don't know how that's even possible. I can't even picture it, but you're asserting that that's possible. Then is time outside of God? And then if there is no temporality in the mind of this God who's outside of time, how do we determine what causality is? Causality is determined by temporal succession. This happened first, this happened later. God didn't create the universe and say, oh, look, what happened? I guess I better decide to do it now. The mind of God has to function in a temporal, causal way if he's going to be a being in any meaningful sense of the word. So your question is meaningless. It's sort of a power game trick. And there are a lot of unanswered questions in science, but to simply plug some of those gaps with your God is irresponsible. You're jumping prematurely to your pet religion conclusion.
Thank you. Mr. Sousa, are you clear on the question, I believe?
I certainly am.
You have 2 minutes.
What we have just heard is 2 interesting things. Number one, I didn't ask him where time came from. I asked him where the universe came from. Now, the universe is an object. It's a material thing. It is of the essence of science and philosophy to ask, where did this thing come from? It is not, if we see a head in the middle of Harvard Yard, we would say, how did this get here? What happened? Richard Dawkins, in an interesting speculation, says maybe life got here because aliens brought it from outer space. Then we might ask, where did the aliens come from? Philosophers, both religious and atheists, have thought it a meaningful question to ask, where did this universe come from? Particularly because it wasn't here before. How did we get something out of nothing? That's the question. Now, in a sense, Dan Barker cleverly swapped the question from where did this big material object, the universe, come from? He has no idea. Atheism has no explanation. The most reasonable explanation is if the universe has a source. It can't be a natural source, by the way, because the universe includes all of nature. It would have to be some very powerful, let's call it omnipotent source. It would have to be a source, if you will, of unbelievable creativity, given this universe that we have, with all its laws and all its operations. My point is, he is ducking the question by proclaiming it meaningless. If this question is meaningless, then all the great atheist thinkers from Nietzsche to Heidegger to Bertrand Russell have been talking nonsense all their lives. All of them, too, thought it meaningful to ask, how did we get something out of nothing? So if he's not willing to address this, you may say, properly basic question, it's sort of like if I were to ask him, how do you know that the past even exists? And he declares, well, I really don't know. Time is really an ethereal concept. Causation itself, this is the kind of gobbledygook that is substituting for a real answer to a real question, which is give an account for why we are here with a universe that we can contemplate. Did this just happen by accident? Did random chemicals produce it? Or is he basically saying he has no answer, and so he's pretending that it's a meaningless question?
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Thank you, Lewis, as well. We'll now be moving on to the second section of the debate. Kelly Bodwin will be asking questions on ethics.
Hi, guys. All right. Our first question here is from Mr. Barker, and this question was in part contributed by the Harvard Radcliffe Christian Fellowship, so you should know it's not all coming from the Secular Society. Mr. Barker, if there is no God, how have you constructed a moral code for yourself? And do you feel that this code is specific to you personally, or can there be absolute morals without religion?
Great. We do whole debates on this topic. There is no morality with a capital M in the universe. Morality is a label for a concept. A functioning mind assigns value to things, and we choose, based on our nature, things that are valuable to us and our species and others. Atheists do not consider that there's a moral code. That's like religious talk, to talk about a moral code. There can be a legal code, of course. A society can make a legal code and we can have laws. But what atheists talk about, and I don't speak for all atheists, but we talk about moral principles. Because a code would say this action is wrong and this action is right. Principles would say this action may be right or wrong depending on the situation. For example, a woman knocks on your front door, you open the door, she's bleeding. She says her husband's trying to kill her. You bring her in and you help her out. Later on, her husband bangs on the door and says, "Do you know where my wife is?" A moral person should lie to that man. There's no code that says never tell a lie. A lie can be a very good thing. A code would say, "Oh, I better be virtuous and always tell the truth." The situation requires that most of the time, truth telling is valuable. But a moral person like Rahab in the Bible, who told a lie to protect God's Israelites, was praised for telling the lie. Moral codes, Paul wrote in the Bible, God is not the author of confusion. Could you think of a single book that's caused more confusion than the Bible? You name it. Christianity doesn't even have a moral code. You name any social issue that's important right now. Gay rights, gay marriage, stem cell research, abortion rights, what? The war, doctor-assisted suicide. What are we struggling with in the world? Devout, Bible-believing Christians fall on both sides of this issue. They don't even have a moral code. Here's what I use, humanism, basically. Most atheists that I know would call themselves humanists, and humanistic morality basically boils down to a very simple principle. It's a principle that's useful and flexible. The principle is this. You can be called an ethical, moral person if you act with the intention of minimizing harm. That's it. There's no big mystery to morality. If it is your intention to act in ways that minimize harm, and harm is a natural thing. Harm is not offending the fragile ego of some deity who wants to be worshipped every Sabbath. Harm is hunger or pain or shelter or whatever it is in the real world.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. I do have to cut you off here. Mr. D'Souza, you have 90 seconds to respond.
This is a question for him, not for both of us.
No, right.
Are you right?
The distinction between codes and principles I accept. I think that that this is not a valid division between theism and atheism. For example, the commandment is often translated, thou shalt not kill. It really means thou shalt not murder. That's, in fact, its context. And so there is a distinction here between killing and killing, one may say, the innocent, or killing premeditatively, or killing for the wrong reason. If you look, for example, at the Christian just war theory, I mean, who can argue that this has not been an enormous contribution to moral thinking in the world? This is the notion, for example, that if there's a war, traditionally wars are fought winner take all. The loser becomes, if you will, the captive of the winner. Christianity said no. Number one, war should be fought only defensively, not offensively. Second of all, you should not in general attack preemptively. Third, your response should be proportionate to the original attack. If someone from a different tribe comes and kills five of your guys, you can't go kill 5,000 of their guys. You should make a proportionate response. There should be some prospect of success. The ultimate goal should be peace and resolution. So here are principles, in a sense, articulated by Christianity into Western civilization that are now the legal underpinning for the UN Charter of Human Rights, for our legal definitions of torture, unreasonable coercion, and so on. So it is simply an historical fact that Christianity has embedded in our civilization, Western civilization, moral principles that even secular people live by. When you look ultimately at his thou shalt not do any harm, it's based on a rejection, one may say, of the idea that we are mere Darwinian primates. If we were...
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Souza. I do have to cut you off there. Mr. Barker, you have 45 seconds to respond.
The concept you just elucidated is quite admirable, but it's not biblical. The biblical God committed mass genocide preemptively. He offered terms of peace to these villages by saying, you can come and convert or we'll kill you. You can be slaves or you can be dead. That's your choice. The God of the Bible is brutal, bloodthirsty, one of the most warm, in fact, he calls himself a God of war. The principles you are explaining are humanistic principles. They are not from the Bible. They might have come from a culture in which Christianity was the dominant religion of the time, but they don't come from the founding document of that culture. So the principle, and in fact, Confucius even said it much better. Confucius said, that which you would not have done unto you, don't do unto others. Confucius had a better understanding long before Christianity, as if it would have never dawned on the human race that there's something wrong with killing without the Ten Commandments. By the way, that Hebrew word ratzak means kill. It does not mean murder. God turned right around and did the same thing and killed in his own book. He's contradictory. He does not even obey his own laws.
All right, thank you, Mr. Barker. I'm sorry, I have to cut you off there.
Our next question is for Mr. D'Souza. We often hear Christians citing Bible verse or Bible principles as proof of morality and immorality. But some of these principles, such as those that pertain to slavery or intense physical punishment, are considered outdated today and are largely ignored by the Christian contingency. Do you believe that some traditional Christian morals are outdated? If so, is it possible that any of today's religious ethics will someday be obsolete?
Mr. D'Souza, you have 2 minutes.
Let's look for a moment at the single and strongest example you gave, which is the example of slavery. Now, slavery has been a universal institution. The Chinese had it, the Indians had it. There was slavery all over Africa. American Indians had slaves long before Columbus. For centuries, slavery was uncontroversial. It required no defenders because it had no critics. It is only in one civilization, the civilization of the West, also known as Christendom, that slavery became controversial. Not, by the way, in the modern era. Many people think this was some sort of Enlightenment idea. No. Between the 4th century and the 10th century, slavery virtually disappeared from Europe, being replaced by serfdom. Very different from slavery. Then in the modern era, first the Quakers and then the evangelical Christians began to say the following. If we are all created equal in the eyes of God, a theological premise, it follows, politically, that no man has the right to rule another man without his consent. This startling idea, and I admit it's a new interpretation of a very old theological principle, this startling interpretation becomes the basis, not only of anti-slavery or abolition, it also becomes the basis of democracy. Because what is the premise of democracy, representative democracy? No man has the right to rule another without consent. These ideas have no clear secular roots. Even Jefferson, who was the most secular of all the founders, the least of a believer, when he came down to saying, what is the source of our rights? He didn't name 4 sources, he named only one, our Creator. Our rights come directly, he thought, from God. The simple assumption of the sacredness of human life, he could think of no other source. And he was a pretty smart guy. And he was a very scientifically minded guy, than God. So my point is, what you call outdated, yes, slavery is outdated. That's because Christianity made it outdated.
Thank you. Susan?
By the way, you pay half as much for a female slave as for a male slave. Jesus talked about there are some slaves who ought to be beat harder than others. You would have thought that this wonderful lawgiver, this wonderful, omnipotent, powerful deity who was coming to give us advice, would have said something about it in one of his parables, maybe? He would have said, by the way, slavery is a bad idea. No, he incorporated slavery. You do know that the churches in the South used the Bible. Senator Pinckney from South Carolina argued that we need to postpone the debate on slavery because the Bible says it. It's our property. God gave it to us. This is part of our order. Slavery is a Christian concept that Christians who were smarter than their founding document outgrew. And it's to their credit, and I applaud those people, that they were in a time that where we did have more progress and more sensitivity, not because of, but in spite of Christianity. Christianity is pro-slavery.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Mr. D'Souza, you have 45 seconds to respond.
If what Dan Barker says is true, he has basically scored a point against the rabbis. And what I mean by this is that very often in referring to the genocidal God, the tribal God, the jealous God, and so on, he is resorting ultimately to snippets from the Old Testament. Now, first of all, I do want to point out that even in Judaism, there is a 2,000-year rabbinic tradition of interpreting these passages. It is only the most ignorant fundamentalist who reads the words literally as if seeing them for the first time. By the way, a funny thought, he was a preacher for 20 years. Had he never read these passages before? How come he continued to preach for so long about them? Nevertheless, my point is, intelligent people read the text in context. As a Christian, I view the Old Testament as incorporated and in some profound way transformed by the New. In some senses, Old Testament teachings are universalized. The jealous God, the tribal God, the God who speaks only to His chosen people, now is in a sense the universal God, the God of all. We are all brothers in Christ. So I think what we're seeing here is a sleight of hand. In a certain sense, what Dan Barker is doing is playing ignorant fundamentalists, reading, if you will, the snippets out of context without any apparent understanding of what Maimonides has said, without any understanding of what Aquinas. There's 2,000 years of tradition. And if science was to be judged by its progress, why can't religion be judged by its progress?
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Kelly, if you have any questions.
I'm going to quote from Batman right now, so bear with me. There's a line that says, it's not who you are underneath, it's what you do that defines you. I want to hear both of your thoughts on this notion. Which is more important, a person's intentions or their actions? Or their faith, you might say, or their works? Mr. Barker, I know you touched on this earlier, so I'd like to turn it over to you. Do you really believe that actions are the only thing that people should be judged by?
I do believe that. I think we should not judge people by their beliefs. If you want to stand on your head and pray to Mother Goose and speak in tongues, I don't care. That's your business. You're not hurting me. You're not hurting. You're not causing unnecessary harm in the world. However, if your belief system causes unnecessary harm, then I, as a moral person, have an obligation to interfere, to stop that harm if I can. For example, if you're one of these Christian sects that believes the Bible, it says the prayer of faith will heal the sick, and if you pray for your children instead of taking them to the doctor, which happens, and children do die from that. The famous Twitchell case was right here in Boston. You remember that case? The judge told the parents, you parents can make martyrs of yourself if you want, but you can't make martyrs of your children as a test of your faith. In that case, it's their actions predicated on their belief. Their actions that are to be judged, and they can be judged as evil people because they're, I'm using the word evil in a natural lowercase sense, by the way. They can be judged because their actions are not intending to minimize real harm in the real world. Ethical people do that. And most atheists and agnostics, we're not barging into churches. We're not interfering with your freedom to worship. We're not telling people they can't believe. We're arguing persuasively that there are good reasons why you should not believe, but we believe in freedom in this country as atheists and agnostics. When was the last time an atheist knocked on your front door and tried to interfere with your beliefs? We would only interfere, and I think most Christians would agree with me, that we would interfere using the state or our own persuasion with the actions of a religious person, or an atheist for that matter, that are not attempting to minimize real harm in the real world.
Within Christianity, in fact, I would argue more broadly within religion, there is a deeper understanding of all this. In a sense, Dan Barker is saying, look, let's not worry about the intentions, let's not worry about the faith, if you will. Let's focus only on the actions. Let me show why, even in a secular sense, this would make nonsense of morality. If there's a little dog sleeping in the middle over here, I slip on a banana skin, fall on the dog, and it dies. And then we have a second dog, a little bit closer to Dan Barker. He walks up to it and begins to stomp relentlessly on the dog. In both cases, we have dead dogs. But clearly, there's a crucial difference of intention. I slipped. I didn't mean to kill the dog. He did. And so moral revulsion would rightly be directed toward him. All of our legal system is based on an acknowledgement that intentions are critical. Otherwise, there would be no distinction between first-degree murder and manslaughter. An accidental death is very different than a deliberate, planned death. So Christianity understands that your mind, your state of mind, is important. And your works are also important. There's been, of course, a big debate between Catholicism and the Protestant churches on this very point. Is it faith or is it works? Look, I see this as a hair-splitting debate. Ultimately, I see faith and works, or intentions and effects, as working as the two sides of a scissors. They work, if you will, you might say, symbiotically, or they work in a coordinated fashion. The Bible says very clearly, for example, that your works show the inner state of your mind. Christ, I think, in one of his most insightful formulations, basically says that the sin is not just in the action, it's also in the contemplation of it. And by the way, we see this in secular application. If somebody plans a murder and takes steps to carry it out, even if he doesn't carry it out, he's still guilty of attempted murder, he can still get life in prison, even though he did nothing. So I think we see here in a very simple example how the theological understanding of morality is deeper, fuller, more rounded, more complex, than a rather shallow view that basically just says, do no harm, and then be done with it.
All right, thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Barker, do you have a question for Mr. D'Souza?
Yeah, I was careful to include intentionality, if you were listening. Intentionality is very important to humanistic ethics. If God talks to you, and I assume you believe God talks to you, right, in some way, communicates to you, the Bible says you can pray, and at least he hears you.
Yes.
If there's communication between you and God, if, and this is hypothetical, but if God told you to kill me because I'm an atheist, if, then would you do it? Would you obey God and kill me because of his order with no, you know, like Isaac and his son? Would you follow God's command to kill me simply because he told you to?
Thank you, Mr. Barker.
Wow, is that the best one you could come up with? Wow. That's rather an easy one, actually. Look, the problem is not, let's say I'm praying, and a little voice, actually an audible voice, that you could capture in a recorder says, go kill Dan Barker. In other words, don't just beat up on Dan Barker in a debate, but go kill Dan Barker. I would say, first of all, gee, that's rather interesting. What a shocking piece of advice. Number one, where is this advice coming from? Who said that? Is it God? It could be. I've been praying. But as a Christian, I don't believe that God is the only big force out there. I actually also believe that there are some evil forces in the world. Frankly, I doubt my own interpretation. I don't doubt God. I doubt my hearing of him. So what do? I consult the scriptures. I hold up the scripture. I turn it upside down. I hold it up to the light. I squeeze lemon juice on it. I don't see in there, go kill Dan Barker. In fact, I see love your enemy. I see forgiveness. I see out of the mouth of Christ, who is God, a very different set of instructions. And so, based on this clear conflict between a defective human sense, go kill Dan Barker, and a very clear contextual, theological, and ethical instruction, I begin to believe that this instruction comes coming from the wrong place. And therefore, Dan, I don't kill you. I listen to you very patiently. I endure you, and then I forgive you.
All right, thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Do you have a question? Do you have a question for Mr. Barker?
I take it that you would not disagree that there are certain things that are absolutely wrong. Wrong in any context. Let's take for a simple example the killing of 6 million Jews. This is objectively wrong. It's not just wrong for Hitler, it's wrong. Now, if we are Darwinian primates, then I want to find out where we get this idea that some things are absolutely wrong. Wrong under any circumstances. If we are Darwinian primates, our main goal is to survive and reproduce. We can actually look at Darwinian morality in the animal kingdom. We often talk about animal rights, but animals don't respect animal rights. It doesn't seem to me that a chimpanzee would be very disturbed if another male chimpanzee walked out and started killing other chimpanzees, or killing other species for that matter. What I'm getting at is this. We human beings seem to exist in two dimensions. On the one hand, we have very clearly this Darwinian imperative, lust, avarice, greed, the desire to perpetuate ourselves, the desire to accumulate harems and so on. I understand that. But there's also another dimension. And this dimension is anti-Darwinian. If I'm walking down the street, I hear someone shouting from the river, help, help, I'm drowning, I'm not a very good swimmer, I want to keep walking, I don't want to take the risk of jumping in. Some little voice haunting in my head is going to keep saying, don't keep walking, turn around, help the guy. Now this is not my son, he's not my neighbor, he is nothing to me, I have no genes in common with him. What is the Darwinian reason for me to help that guy? And if objective morality does not come from our Darwinian nature, where does it come from?
Thank you, Mr. Susan. Mr. Barker?
The most moral thing you could do might be not to jump in. It might be to jump in. I think I'm like you. I think Thomas Jefferson said, I don't know if he was right, but Thomas Jefferson said he thinks we were all born with instincts to compassion. We inherited them from our ancestors. There's a lot of research now on the evolution of altruism and reciprocal altruism. Even primates are showing that. So science is showing that there can be an evolutionary adaptive explanation for why, especially you see it with your own children, you invest more time into your own kids than into your nieces and nephews and into your neighbors and that. And yet, it doesn't disappear to zero. We are a species, and we care about the genetic information of our species, and we have evolved, if you will, a kind of blind need to care for our own. That's natural. If I heard the person in the river, I would have to think. I'm like you. I probably just want to jump in. I mean, atheists do that thing all the time by instinct. And they might be called a hero or stupid, depending on what happened. I want to know, how far out is the person? How strong is the current? How good of a swimmer am I? How many children am I responsible for supporting? Would it be better, or is it more likely, rationally, that there would be two deaths instead of one? Maybe the most rational thing to do, if I have time to think it through, would be not to jump in and go get help instead. You can't pull a list from your back pocket and say, oh, there's an absolute moral code that tells me what to do here. Let's see, rule number 136. Oh, always jump in the river when someone... What if you were drowning in the river, you're screaming for help, and you saw an 82-year-old woman with a cane up there? Would you want her to jump in? Would you expect that? You would say, no, please, don't. You would not want her to risk her life and kill both of you. Rational dilemmas require the use of a careful analysis of the relative merits of the competing consequences of various actions we have in front of us, if we have the time and the knowledge, which means a rational person must be as informed as possible to know, I mean, does this pesticide or this one cause more harm to the environment? We have to inform ourselves to know. And then, if you have the intention of acting in a way that results in minimal amounts of harm, you are, by definition, a moral person. And part of that comes from our inherited ancestors, this altruistic. Part of it just comes from the fact that we are rational creatures and we can override instincts to violence or to selfishness because we have been taught and educated by our family and by example that we do care about it. And by the way, on the bell curve of human personalities, some of us care more than others. There are psychopaths and sociopaths that don't care about harm because they are mentally sick. I assume that you and I are mentally healthy enough that we fall somewhere in the middle of that distribution, that we do want to be altruistic by some kind of instinct and some kind of rational thought.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barker. We'll now have Zoe Kowaler, who will be asking questions on politics.
For the first question, this is for each of you. I'd like you to describe what you believe to be the ideal relationship between church and state. And in particular, if a politician believes that his moral principles derive from religion, how can he or she separate their beliefs from their political decisions? We'll start with...
I think we'll start with Ms. Barker.
Okay. Separation between church and state should be absolute, complete, meaning that the state as state, that a state government public servant as working in that position must be neutral about religion, must not advance or hinder religion. The state working as state represents all of us. The state worker, though, the government worker, is an individual who has freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. Of course, that person has every right to be informed by their particular Muslim, Jewish, Christian, whatever principles they have, because they assume that the electors knew that. And so, of course, they can be informed by that. I mean, it's a free country. We can't tell people what to think and what to believe. But the government as government, when government resources, government endorsement, government... property is being used for any reason, it must be neutral on religion. You can't have the freedom of religion in America or in any country if you don't have the freedom to dissent from it. So the government has to back off. In this country, you and I are free to disagree about religious issues. We are totally free to disagree and have this debate. What we are not free to do is ask our government to settle the argument. Our government has to fold its arms and let us fight it out amongst ourselves. And by the way, let the audience decide who's beating up on whom. But President Bush can go to church and be photographed going to church and speaking at private functions. Of course, you know, any public servant can do that. It's a free country. But as president, as governor, as a school principal, they have to back off and be neutral and do their job for all of us. Because as soon as you pick one religion to advance or to hinder, either way, then you are offending some of the taxpayers that are paying your salary and who have voted you into office.
All right, thank you, Mr. Barker.
The concept of distinguishing government and religion is, in fact, an invention of Christianity. Interestingly, you see no such division in ancient Judaism. When Moses came down from the mountain, there was no question of religious freedom for his brother and the people worshipping the golden calf. Similarly, in Islam, church and state are united. Christ, in saying, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, rendering unto God what is God's, in a sense invented a new idea. Now, from the beginning of Christianity, church and government as institutions have been separate. By the way, people think, oh, they were all... Yes, they were. When Constantine, the Roman Empire, converted to Christianity... there was a blending, if you will, of church and state, but still not completely. Even under the Spanish Inquisition, if you were tried for blasphemy, you were tried by the church. If you were tried for murder, you were tried by the state. Now, here's the point I want to make. And that is, in a sense, Dan Barker is arguing as if it was obvious that the notion of distinguishing religion and government leads to what he calls an absolute separation of church and state. I want to argue that this is an exaggeration, a distortion,
and a really a profoundly undemocratic suggestion for the following reason. We have in this society believers and unbelievers. In fact, if the polls can be believed, the believers are a majority. Now, essentially, this is what is Dan Barker's idea of fairness, and indeed the ACLU, Freedom from Religion Foundation, and so on. And that is this. Let's go to the public square, which is our shared democratic space. Let's identify all the religious opinions. Let's kick them out. What does that mean? Are we being neutral? No. We are making the public square the exclusive property of secularism and atheism. And so, for example, if Dan Barker proposed in the public square, let's build a monument to the greatest atheist who ever lived, let's say David Hume. This would be permitted. It's secular. If I were to say, let's build a monument to the greatest theist who ever lived, Jesus Christ, he would say, you're violating the separation of church and state. How is this fair?
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Zoe, another question?
In the interest of time, I'm only going to ask one more question. So, each of you, I'm assuming, attaches some moral value to the dignity of human life. So what are your views on abortion and capital punishment? Do you attach a different value to the life of a fetus than to that of a convict?
Thank you. Mr. D'Souza, if you'd like to answer first.
I think of abortion and capital punishment as in some ways related and in some ways distinct. They're clearly related in the sense that they both involve the taking of life. They, in some ways, involve the deliberate taking of life. In that sense, an element of intentionality is involved in both situations. They're different for the reason that we discussed earlier, and that is the question of guilt or innocence. I think it would be hard to argue in any sense that a fetus, assuming it has a right to life, deserves to die. One feminist writer described the fetus as an uninvited guest, which it may be in the womb. But even so, it is morally in a very different position than the guy, the serial killer, who goes out and massacres, let's say, five people at Virginia Tech or more. So that's the key difference. Abortion is a difficult issue. My own thinking on it has been shaped a little bit by looking at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which are very fascinating. And by the way, I'm not making some crude analogy with slavery. But the Lincoln-Douglas debates were ultimately over what to do about the expansion of slavery into the territories. Interestingly, Douglas argued the pro-choice view. Douglas said, listen, I don't care if you have slavery. I don't care if you don't have it. I am indifferent to whether slavery is voted up or down. But I think we should agree to disagree. We shouldn't have a rule. We should let each state, each community decide for itself if it wants to vote yes or no on slavery. Lincoln made a very profound rebuttal to this. He says you cannot defend choice without attention to the content of what is being chosen. This is a moral evasion. He says ultimately the real question is the Negro a human being or is the Negro the moral equivalent of a hog? If the Negro is the moral equivalent of a hog, then my opponent is right. We can decide up or down. We can be morally indifferent. But if the fetus is a human being, or if the slave is a human being, the question settles itself. Choice becomes irrelevant. So, similarly on the abortion issue, I would like to see a little bit more. There's too much easy refuge in the principle of choice. I think that evades something that we as a society like to evade, and that is the status of the unborn. And this is particularly ironic in an age of compassion, at a time when you may say the orbits of compassion are stretching further out to encompass, in some cases, not only the marginalized groups, but in some cases even animals. Peter Singer, who I'll be debating on Friday in L.A., wants apes to have the rights enshrined in the U.N. Charter. So we are going beyond our species. We are reaching far and wide. Apparently the only candidate for exemption in this widening circle of moral compassion is the one candidate that gets in our way.
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Barker, same question.
I don't speak for all atheists, obviously. There are some atheists who are anti-abortion. There are some atheists who are pro-death penalty. Most of the atheists that I know happen to be socially liberal, but not all of them. But I can speak for myself at least tonight. The humanistic morality really is not concerned with punishment. Humanistic morality is concerned with protecting society from unnecessary harm. So a humanist being ethical would say we need to exercise the minimal amount of protection or restraint necessary to avoid harm, unnecessary harm to society. We think that capital punishment crosses that line. We think there are ways to protect society. We don't care if that prisoner feels bad or feels punished. I mean, that's not our business. What we care is that society is protected. So, speaking for myself, it is, if we're trying to tell people killing is wrong, and if you do it, we're going to kill you, the state's going to kill you, well, then the state is just as complicit in killing and just as immoral. Other atheists disagree with me, but that's my position as a humanistic atheist. I support a woman's right to choose an abortion. Jesus never said anything about a woman with an unwanted pregnancy. He was silent on the issue. I think Christians should be as well. I think for most women, an abortion is a blessing in her life. It is a wonderful thing. Obviously, there's a difference between a fetus that's the size of a thumb that has what would you put it in a little locket and hang it around your neck? It's not a fully developed, it's like the difference between an acorn and a tree. Obviously, there's some potential there. Every sperm has potential. Every sperm wants to be a future being as well. And yet we don't make masturbation a crime, right? So we have to make moral distinctions. And I think the reason I support a woman's right to choose is that it's her problem. It's her issue. It's none of your business or mine to butt in with her private decision with her doctor and with her priest and her rabbi and her lawyer.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. In the interest of time, we're going to skip the questions for this section and move along to next section, which is pluralism. Andrew Meyer will be asking the questions.
This question is going to be for both of you, but I'm going to phrase it a little differently for each one. Mr. Barker, as a former preacher with great familiarity with Christianity, what do you think that atheists can learn from Christians that they might not otherwise be exposed to? And Mr. D'Souza, what do you think Christians can learn from atheists in our society? Mr. Barker, could you go first?
Well, we can learn a lot from modern Christians. There are many modern Christians who are wonderful people. In fact, I will march shoulder to shoulder with some of them. One of my friends, Tom Malone in Atlanta, is an outspoken atheist, but he marched shoulder to shoulder with the Baptists in the civil rights movement. Many atheists and agnostics and secular people were involved in civil rights and in the abolition of slavery and all of that. It's just that we didn't wear it on, like, you know, we're showing that we are atheists and that's why we're doing it. And when you think about it, when an atheist does a good deed without any prospect of a future reward or avoiding punishment, isn't it more moral than a believer? I think we can learn a lot from Christians who have a sense of community. They have a sense of togetherness and community. For a lot of atheists, that's difficult to find. Many of them join the Unitarian Church, which is a great place for that. And by the way, Unitarianism is a great cover if you're running for public office. Others of us don't feel that need for community, but if you do, we can see that model. In fact, it was the churches that became rallying points for Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement because it was a good place for community to come together. So I also think we can maybe learn and appreciate some of the music that's in. You know, I'm a musician and I play Christian music. I don't miss the Christian lyrics, but some of that music, Ave Maria by Schubert, I think is gorgeous, although I don't believe in the Virgin Mary. I learned from his feeling of evocation, of adoration for someone that he loves, that I don't. I can still get into that spirit and feel this very human expression. So I think we can learn a lot from modern Christians. I don't think there's much to learn from the document upon which Christianity is based. That Bible, which, by the way, I am interpreting in context, in know it at least as well as you do. If you can figuratively dismiss a lot of the things, then why not dismiss God as one huge figure of speech as well?
Thank you, Mr. Barker.
I appreciate your comments. I take them as, in a certain way, a refutation of a theme in Christopher Hitchens when he says how religion poisons everything. One of the things that's, I think, very exasperating about this new atheism is its uncritical nature. I mean, religion hasn't poisoned Bach or Dante or Milton or a great part of our sacred music, our literature, our culture, the Gothic cathedrals, this building, are the product, if you will, of religious inspiration. It's formed our civilization. Even the atheist should have the dignity to admit that, and I'm glad you have. For my part, I actually value very much the atheist critique. Now, I value it, if you will, at its best. In some senses, you know, when a Richard Dawkins, who's really a biologist, wanders into medieval theology and in one paragraph essentially goes, take that Aquinas, I have to chuckle. because this is ultimately what happens when a biologist is allowed to leave the lab. You get something rather embarrassing. However, the great atheists I mentioned earlier, I think have given us a very profound way to think about how do we know what we know. By the way, this started in the Enlightenment. There wasn't that much atheism in the Enlightenment. There were a few, a couple of the French philosophers were atheists. But mostly the Enlightenment was an objection, not to Christianity, but an unholy alliance, you may say, between throne and altar. And that's what pushed a lot of people toward deism. But we've seen great atheists in the last 100 years. By the way, I probably spend more time reading them than I do Christian apologetics. If you read my book, What's So Great About Christianity, the people most frequently cited are people like Nietzsche. Nietzsche was in some ways very deep, very prophetic. Essentially, he argued in a nutshell that if you remove God, if you kill God, he says, don't be shallow enough to think that you can preserve Christian morality. Be nice to people, believe in equality, believe in human dignity. He goes, Christianity brought those values into the world. When you kill God, those values begin to erode. In a sense, what he was doing is saying that you can't have it all. A lot of the new atheists today are in some shallow sense, saying we don't want God, but we'll keep all the other principles. For example, the idea of do no harm presumes the equal dignity of the other man's life. But that's a Christian invention. Go back to ancient Greece and Rome, you won't find it. The Spartans, when they found the sick child, they didn't want it. Leave it on the hillside in the winter, find it dead in the morning. That's not the shocking thing. The great thinkers of ancient Greece, Plato, Aristotle, they knew about this. They didn't care. They viewed it with equanimity. And why? Because the preciousness of human life was simply not an important value in ancient Greece and Rome.
Sorry, I have to cut you off here.
Of course.
Andrew, do you have another question?
We in the Harvard Secular Society wanted to host this debate in order to provide a productive discourse between two sides that are often seen as opposing forces. Mr. D'Souza, do you personally believe that these type of debates, or how do you believe that these type of debates benefit the society? And the same question will go to Mr. Barker afterwards.
We might finally find a point of agreement, and this would be very good. Look, 100 years ago, you could go to Columbia. You could listen to a debate on, is God dead? It would be a public debate in a public forum. Somehow theological debates about these, you may call them big questions, have vanished from American public life. In a certain sense, to complete my answer to the last question, I'm grateful to the new atheists. They have put the issue front and center on the table. Great. It's actually very good for Christians, by the way. Why? Because a lot of Christians have forgotten that they have one foot in secular society. If you ask them, why do you think this or why do you think that, they'll reply, because the Bible says this, the book of Leviticus says that, the Gospel of Luke says this. And of course, if you're Dan Barker, you're going to say, who cares what the Bible says? Or, to put it differently, who cares anymore what the Bible says, since he used to care. But who cares anymore what the Bible says? So there is a rejection of the shared Christian assumptions that once shaped our society. This is the fact of our time. The reason I think these kinds of debates are very useful is that they force both sides not only to engage, that's healthy in itself, to debate the fairness of the public square. I don't want to leave it all to himself. I would like to see a rule of fairness allowing believers and non-believers equal access to the public square. Not this absolute separation, which is essentially a strategy to drive the Christians out and keep the public square safe for atheism. Finally, I think that it's also useful because it forces atheists to confront their hidden metaphysical assumptions. Very often in the academy, atheism is presented as synonymous with sophistication. This is a bogus intellectual move that leads young people to think, I think wrongly, that as you become educated, you should slough off your beliefs in God because they are somehow unreasonable or irrational. This is the prejudice of our time. This is the reigning prejudice at Harvard. So the reason I'm here is to speak not only to Christians, but also to non-believers and say, hey, let's apply the critical lens even-handedly. Let's recognize the faith-based assumptions in our beliefs, even in modern science.
Thank you, Mr.
Overall, it's a healthy debate.
Thank you.
If we want a world that has less violence and more understanding in it, then we need to remove as much as possible sources of social conflict, especially unnecessary sources of social conflict, because there's always going to be fights over water rights or property rights or who knows what. But religion, at its core, is divisive. Religion builds walls between people, insiders, outsiders.
the chosen versus the damned, the elect versus the evil, the infidel. And it causes, we see through history, that this religious divisiveness, even within the same religion, the 30 years war, Northern Ireland, we see that religion is, it creates this unnecessary thing that people have to fight about. It wouldn't get rid of all social conflict, but it would be wonderful if we could educate. Debates like this can serve a purpose of educating to the fact that most religious claims that are based on faith are irrational, and if they're irrational, then they are dangerous to our thought processes, which we need even more desperately as the world gets tougher and tougher to live in. And the faith of the founders of the religion was basically an irrational thing. Most of the founders, like Joseph Smith, Muhammad, Jesus, they were these kind of obsessive compulsive people who thought they had to shape the world into their view. And look at how all these sheep just fall along. That is dangerous to be sheep. We should not be slave. Paul called himself a slave of Christ, proudly. And Paul said that a Christian should bring into captivity every thought unto the obedience of Christ. Captivity is not freedom. In Proverbs, it's lean not on your own understanding. And it also says there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the ends thereof are ways of death. That is dangerous, to surrender your mind to someone else's mind, be it a god or a dictator or a master or a church or a pope. It is better for the world if we learn from debates like this that, hey, we atheists aren't just a whole bunch of mad, angry people because we want to be free to sin and go out and kill and rape. But we atheists actually have reasons for why we reject. And I think that's a very useful educational and public thing.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. This ends our questions for the debate. We'll now move into the question and answer portion. For this, we have the pleasure of having John Figdor, an MTS candidate at Harvard Divinity School, to moderate this portion. Mr. Figdor?
We'll begin with a question from our esteemed colleague, Andrew Chen, from the Harvard Radcliffe Christian Fellowship. While he will be able to ask a follow-up question, I will ask that the rest of you refrain from doing so in the interest of time. Thank you very much. Andrew?
And then we have 2 minutes for, sorry, 1 minute actually for each of these answers.
Sorry, we each get to go.
Yeah. We'll actually go up the fence for each ask.
Hi. In light of the design of this debate and debates in general,
is there more water anywhere?
What value do each of you place in humility, and how do you feel like you express humility in your personal lives?
Did he say humility?
Yes.
Okay. You go ahead if you want.
You have 1 minute, Mr. Souza.
It is the beginning of humility to recognize that our knowledge as deciphered through reason is necessarily limited. We cannot operate on the assumption that the things we know now are all there is to know, or, in a certain sense, the premise of modern atheism, if I don't see the evidence, I know it doesn't exist. I think that humility is also a value, it's an intellectual virtue. It is also a civic virtue, because, again, as fallible human beings, see, the Christian assumption is that, it was stated by Immanuel Kant, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. And this, in a sense, makes us realize that morally, intellectually, we're not perfect. We're flawed. That means the other guy might have it right. And so in this sense, I think that Christ is a certain model for the man who, not that he didn't have a sense of what's right and wrong, but he was gentle in the way he treated people, gentle in the way that he approached even sin, which as the inventor of Christianity, he would hate. But nevertheless, let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. I'm sorry. Is there a follow-up question, Andrew?
I do have a follow-up question. Mr. D'Souza, to what extent do you admit that your views do not represent the Christian faith as a whole?
Well, I mean, I think we are all speaking as individuals. I certainly no appointed spokesman for any belief system. I'm really a scholar, a political scientist. I've really been a secular scholar. For 15 years, I've written books on markets and other topics. This is my first book about Christianity. So my personal faith has deepened over the years,
And this is the first time my intellectual life and, if you will, my faith have come together. So, I'm speaking for no one but myself. What I'm trying to do is something perhaps a little different. There's Christian apologetics and most of it goes on within the churches. What I'm trying to do, if you will, is engage atheism on its own ground. So you'll notice, for example, that at no point today have I appealed to authority or revelation or an encyclical or even scripture. I've essentially argued on the same terms as Dan Barker. And that's why it shocks me that he basically says these religious views have to be somehow excluded from the public square because they are dangerous. Meanwhile, apparently his views are perfectly safe. And they should have a monopoly in the public square. This strikes me as ludicrous.
Thank you,
Mr. D'Souza. I'd like to ask you a question. You stated that the God was omniscient earlier in the presentation. Now, accepting that term, I would like for you to ask how an omniscient entity, when creating this planet and the human beings, could screw up so badly. They had Adam and Eve. Their first progeny was a murderer, and going through 10 or 15 generations, this omniscient entity had to acknowledge that he had made such a mess that every man, woman, and child was murdered by drowning. And not too long after that, he murdered his own so-called begotten son to correct for these failures of his own creation. And this doesn't sound like an omniscient entity to my understanding of the English words. I mean, I would expect competence.
Yes. When I was at Dartmouth, one of the things I learned was in answering an objection, in critiquing a view, always try first to state the view from the inside. Try to state the view as the advocate of that view might hold it. And then attack that. Because otherwise you're attacking a straw man. Now, the first thing I would say is, what is the Christian understanding of omniscience? And is the God that we see in the world inconsistent with that? The Christian understanding of omniscience is the following. Number one, God created the universe and a lawful universe. God created man and woman, and created them with free will. Now, he could have done it differently. He could have created us automatons. He could have made us robots. The Christian view is that for whatever reason, and you can dispute it, he created free will. Now, freedom in the essence of it, and Dan swears by freedom as his core principle, as you know, freedom is the freedom to choose the good, but it is not freedom if it doesn't have the equivalent freedom to deny the good, to choose the evil. And so Christians are not surprised to see evil in the world, particularly moral evil. It is the direct consequence of giving human beings free will.
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Thank you. Next question, please.
This question is for Mr. D'Souza. You want to argue against atheism on its own grounds. You've given very short shrift to faith in these arguments, and you've taken pains to show out the faith-based assumptions in science. So it seems to me you're approaching this whole issue of the existence of God more or less on an empirical basis. My question to you is, what's your evidence for God? Why should an atheist like myself and many of us here take it as trustworthy?
I'll give you one piece of evidence that's rooted in modern science. In recent decades, scientists have asked a very interesting question. Our universe operates according to very specific numerical values. For example, the gravitational force is so strong, the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the electroweak force. Here's the question. What if these numerical values were a little different? And this is a question Stephen Hawking addresses in A Brief History of Time. And he argues that if you come in and if you think of God as sitting with a bunch of dials, let's say 100 dials, if you touch one of the dials, in this case the rate of expansion of the universe, and move it, not 10%, not 1%, one part in 100,000,000,000,000,000, you would have no universe, you would have no life. Now, the point I'm making here is, I'm not talking about the fact that we live on a lucky planet Earth, so I don't want a distortion of the argument. I'm saying the entire universe has to be as big as it is, and as old as it is, and have the numerical values it does in order for us to be here having this conversation. The universe is a giant conspiracy, it seems, to produce, well, us.
This is an argument for design that is completely immune to Darwinian attack. I have never heard a semi-intelligent atheist explanation of why the universe is fine-tuned in this way. I would like to invite Dan Barker, when he has time, to provide one.
Time. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza.
I'm curious as to what the final straw was for you, and when you stopped being a Christian. It was probably a gradual process, but I'd like to know what the final straw was. Thank you.
It was a gradual process. It took 4 or 5 years, starting as a fundamentalist minister, believing every word of the Bible was true. Obviously, I knew there was metaphor in the Bible. When Jesus said he was a door, we don't look for hinges, but I believed that the Bible was true, and I went through a gradual migration where there was no one thing. It started off with things like the historicity of Adam and Eve. Did I have to believe that or not? Moved into more biblical criticism and realizing that the Bible was put together so sloppily, it is so contradictory, it is so unreliable, and then when my eyes were open to look at it from outside to see, wow, it's even uninspiring and even dangerous, I moved into more of a liberal Christianity, and eventually I dumped out all the bathwater and I said, hey, there's no baby there. This whole thing is just one huge figure of speech. There was no final straw. If there had been one final straw, it'd be like asking you, when did you grow up? You know, you probably couldn't point to one thing, but you could point to a process in your life. But, so it was just a gradual maturing and growing up.
Thank you. Next question, please.
This is a question directed primarily at Mr. D'Souza, but I would hope Mr. Barker would also comment. My question is this. If you believe in religion, it seems to me that you believe in miracles and you believe in things that seem impossible to common sense without any evidence to support it. Don't you worry about the consequences of that kind of thinking? Many people who are anti-religious say if you believe in religion, you believe in miracles, you believe in mystical things, you believe in things that defy common sense, and it softens the...
Please keep your questions short, please.
It softens the quality of your thought and leaves you open to all kinds of delusions and illusions that may be dangerous. Isn't that a problem with religious belief? And what does Mr. Barker think about that, too?
No. It was Bertrand Russell who described common sense as, quote, the metaphysics of the savage. In fact, it is the whole history of science that shows that you can't go by common sense. Common sense denies that the Earth is traveling at several thousand miles an hour. For many centuries, it wasn't just religious people. It was scientists who opposed Copernicus and later Galileo because it violated common sense. They thought that ultimately, if the Earth is moving so fast and you throw a stone, it's not going to land where you dropped it. It's going to land many yards away. So I think that common sense is not always a reliable guide. Well, the deep question we have to ask is there anything in modern science that invalidates the possibility of miracles? The somewhat surprising answer to that question is no. Science is based ultimately, you might say, on laws. But what are these laws? These laws are generalizations based on empirical examples. For centuries in Western civilization... I'm sorry,
you're out of time, Mr. D'Souza.
Well, I agree about science and even about history. History, to be useful, has to assume natural regularity across time. And I think you then would agree with me that history is impotent to even prove the miracles of the Bible, for example, because history has to make those similar assumptions. It can't prove them true or false. They have to be taken by faith. That a snake and a donkey spoke human language, that a disembodied hand floated in the air and wrote on the wall, that food rained down from the sky, that a man walked on water unaided. These things that we know don't happen. In fact, if they did happen all the time, they wouldn't count as miracles of how powerful God is. The miracle is something which only counts because it goes against what we know as natural regularity. So you better hope that the scientific method disallows that, basically, based on our experience, so that the miracles can count for it. Otherwise, you're just yanking miracles into the natural world, and they are not really an act of God at all. They're just as yet unknown technological things that we haven't yet figured out with our limited brains.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Dr. D'Souza.
Two questions, one on religion, one on God. If God comes to you and asks to kill Dan Baker, otherwise you'll go to hell, will you do that? And if you don't, does that mean that you are actually obeying rationalism but not religion? The second question is, do you honestly believe your assumption that creation needs a creator, although we cannot answer who created God?
I'll focus on the second question, and that is...
Okay.
I'm sorry?
The
first question is asked and answered. He came late to the debate.
No, I didn't. I put the question that if God tells you to kill him, unless you, or else you go to hell, and if you don't do it, then that's actually your rationalism, but not religious belief.
No, I was saying that we human beings live in a world of epistemological doubt. Job, Abraham, Isaiah, none of us sees God. It's not an atheist idea, we don't see God. And therefore, God is an immaterial being. And so to say things like, God's going to show up for us to believe in him and stand right here, this is setting a test which... the question you have to ask is, what evidence would it take for us to recognize God as the immaterial being he is posited to be? Now, the point I'm trying to make here is that we human beings see through a glass darkly, St. Paul's phrase. And this means that we have no single way of knowing. We believe, but we operate in a domain of doubt. See, I think one interesting fact that's emerging in this debate is the Christian is more tentative, in some ways more agnostic, more open to the possibility that he or she is wrong. The atheist is serenely self-confident. I've never seen a miracle, so they can't be miracles. You know, for 2,000 years in Western civilization, the phrase as white as a swan was as close to a law because it had millions of corroborating examples. Then the white man landed in Australia and saw black swans.
Time. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza.
No more law.
Next question, please.
My question is for Mr. Barker and Mr. D'Souza. And I was just wondering what both of you thought of why women are almost universally excluded from religious decision-making hierarchies, and specifically Christianity.
Go ahead.
There is a book written by a noted... evolutionary biologist that is called The Inevitability of Patriarchy. It's an important book because it makes a Darwinian argument, by the way, seconded by leading atheists like Steven Pinker, I believe now at Harvard, formerly at MIT, arguing that these male-female differences are rooted in evolutionary biology. In other words, religion doesn't invent these things. The argument is, and this is an argument made with impeccable scientific and atheist credentials, that these things are in nature. And in a sense, you might say, religion assigns differential sacramental authority based on these presumed differences. Now, frankly, I doubt the biology. Because this is a case where a theological argument is sitting on top of what is presumed to be natural. The same, by the way, the debate about homosexuality, same thing. The idea that homosexuality is unnatural is not an invention of religion. People didn't say, oh, you know what? The book of Leviticus, and therefore...
Time.
No.
Time. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Barker?
You're very right. The Bible is a very sexist and patriarchal book. The women are devalued. Women are viewed as property. In the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass nor thy neighbor's wife. Women are something to be accessed and controlled. It's assumed that it's written to men. God is the Father. He got a woman pregnant. She had a son. He has male disciples. So I think it's a big component of many religions. And whether it's religion's fault or whether you're right that religion is just borrowing from something in human nature, I don't know if I can answer that question. But in any event, religion still perpetuates the sexism that we find abhorrent, especially in the Bible. And when Paul said that women should keep silent in church, they should just learn from their husbands and be quiet, that no woman should have authority over a man, those are direct biblical teachings putting women down. I debated a Muslim scholar once in Queens, and I said, I think Islam is basically all about control of access to females. I think that's basically what the whole thing is. Muhammad, Joseph Smith with the polygamy and the women, and he got a revelation from God.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Thank you. Next question, please.
Yes, this is for both of you. Pascal's Wager, I'll phrase it slightly differently. Pascal's Wager asks the unbeliever to be concerned about the consequences with respect to salvation of his lack of belief. So, Mr. Barker, what about that? And for Mr. D'Souza, if you're on the other hand wrong, what about the consequences, all the women who can't have abortions, all the gay people who haven't been able to have fulfilling lives, all the cases of AIDS because of lack of condom distribution? The consequences of your belief might be wrong, both of you.
Was that two questions, or what was
it? Yeah, I think we'll just have, can we just have the part of it for it addressed at you in the interest of time?
Pascal's Wager is not only a bad argument, it's a non-argument. Pascal's Wager is an argument from intimidation, basically. If you don't have the right choice, then you're going to burn forever, you're going to suffer. With this kind of reasoning, you should pick the religion with the worst hell in it, because that's the one that you have the most to lose from. Maybe Islam has the worst hell, and you Christians will die someday and be very surprised. I have a Dan Barker's Wager, that I can play the same game that you can. Suppose there is a God, but he's only going to reward those people who have enough courage not to believe in him. That's a possibility, isn't it? Isn't that a possibility? And then you believers are going to be very surprised someday, and so will we atheists. You can't. This wager is just an intimidation game. It's a worthless as an argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the power of Pascal's Wager is this. We live in a world where life comes to an end, and we don't know what comes after. There are some questions in which we don't know, and yet it would make a big difference to our lives if we did know. It's a little bit like this.
If I'm dating a woman, and I can date her for 10 years, if I ask the question, in deciding whether to propose, what would life with her be like over the next 50 years? The truth is, I'll never know. I've got to make a decision based on what I do know. I've got to weigh the risks. I've got to weigh the odds. Now, I could say, you know what? I'm going to be agnostic. I'm going to wait for the data to come in. If you're an agnostic, she's going to marry someone else. Or you'll both be dead. In other words, this is the kind of question, the kind of knowledge you're demanding is not forthcoming. This is the power of Pascal's Wager. It exposes the fraud of the agnostic who pretends like he's waiting for data. Pascal says you have
time
to wager.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza.
And it has consequences.
Thank you. Mr. D'Souza, I recently read your book, and you were kind enough to respond to a couple of emails that I sent you. I really didn't feel like you answered my question, so I want to try it again. And I appreciate the fact that you brought up something just absolutely wrong, 6 million Jews. And I feel like I'm really quite sympathetic to faith, but certain things to me just seem to be so unethical that I have to reject them. Now, it seems that there's Jesus loves you Christianity, and you love Jesus or you go to hell Christianity. And I'm wondering, the 6 million Jews that were murdered by the Nazis and their supporters, hundreds of millions of Christians still are taught and believe that if those Jews died, apparently not believing in Jesus, they would go to hell. Whether it's Anne Frank or the Polish doctor who went to Treblinka with the orphans.
Please,
the question is right here. So, do you believe in a Christ where there's any possibility at all that Jews murdered for being Jews could be sent to hell or denied access to heaven because they died as Jews, not as Christians? Any possibility?
Well, I wouldn't answer as to possibilities, but I will say
I'm asking you if you believe there's any possibility. That's the question.
Is there any
possibility that Jesus Christ would deny access to heaven or send people to hell because they were murdered by Nazis for being Jews and they died as Jews, not Christians, and they knew about Christianity and didn't believe it?
Let me clarify. You're saying that you're trying to hold me to the proposition that all 6 million Jews, by virtue of being killed by Hitler, should be given automatic entree to heaven?
No, just the ones that were good people, didn't believe
it. Sorry, there shouldn't be any back and forth now.
Right.
You have 1 minute to the question.
Look, I'll answer your question in general about non-believers. Is that satisfactory?
No, that's not answering my question.
I'm sorry, he has 1 minute to speak.
Okay, well, I think you're trying to appropriate, if you will, the moral horror of the Holocaust
to try to score a theological point, whereas I'm addressing the question at its deep principled core, which is, as a Christian, what do I think is going to happen to non-Christians? Right? Are they denied salvation? My answer is, as far as I know, no. But I don't know. Look, Christianity states a positive teaching, which is to say, Christ is the way to heaven. If you embrace Christ, this is where you're going. You will have salvation in some profound sense. I do want to note, by the way, that for many leading atheists, and I mentioned Christopher Hitchens here very clearly, he says, look, I don't want to go to heaven. He says, it's like celestial North Korea. He says, I don't want to stand and hand out garlands. He says, I'd rather stay out of it. If there's a place like that, count me out. I think this is very important because in Christian theology, it's not that God is grabbing the atheist and flinging him into hell. The atheist, in a sense, the Bible says in a very profound verse, the salvation is the gift of God. Okay, now, many people think this means God gives us the gift of salvation. Wrong. Salvation is not the gift from God.
Time.
Salvation is the gift of God. God is the gift.
Time. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza.
You can say no to it.
Next question, please.
For Mr. Barker, you used to preach the Bible, and now you're saying that you've recanted from your former beliefs. You say that you're in pursuit of truth, but there's no moral lawgiver. Now that you've recanted of Christianity, how can we be sure of anything you say from that point forward?
Well, I'm not asking you to believe me. I'm presenting arguments and evidences that you are welcome to run around in your own mind and decide for yourself. I'm not an authority. When I was a minister, I had some reverend before my name, some authoritative credentials that held some weight in certain denominations. But now I'm not an authority. Atheism is not a movement of followers. It's a movement of leaders. Every atheist, every humanist is a leader. So I have demonstrated to you that I have the humility and flexibility of mind to admit that I was wrong when I was wrong, and do that again. I would be happy to do it again if you would persuade me. I'm open to that. And by the way, Dinesh mischaracterizes atheists when he says that we claim to know with certainty. That's not how I define atheism at all. Atheism is an absence of a belief. You're attacking a straw man. So don't believe me. Look it up for yourself.
Next question, please.
Yes, this question is for Dan Barker. You talked about mentally sick, being mentally healthy. You use words like good, evil, harm. And I know a lot of people in this place take those words for granted, especially if they don't believe in God. My question is, two parts. Where do you get good and evil from if you don't believe in God? What's the standard? And where does the conscience inside every human being that tells us that there's a standard we ought to reach to and we realize that we don't? Where's that from?
Good and evil are just lowercase words that are labels for concept. And the way I define it, and I don't speak for all atheists or even all humanists, but the way I define it, you can be called a good person if it truly is your intention to act in ways that minimize harm. Even if you fail, if it is your intention to be a person who wants less harm overall in the world. You can't get rid of harm. There has to be some harm. I mean, I think we would all agree it's wrong to stick a needle into a baby unless that baby needs a life-saving injection. We have to sometimes balance these ethical problems. So evil, by definition, there's no such cosmic thing as evil, but by definition, within ourselves, in the context of our species and what we value, evil, we would label those people who do not act with that intention, or people who maliciously act to cause unnecessary harm. And I think we agree that the less mentally healthy a person is, the more likely they are to be psychopathic or sociopathic. The consciousness that comes is consciousness is a function of a brain, of a mind. And as the mind functions in this environment, we make value judgments. What we should we eat
Barker,
it, run away from it, fight with it, mate with it? That's
Thank
a
you,
physical
Barker.
Thing.
Next question, please.
Mr. D'Souza, you described earlier your experience as a child being raised as your parents' knee as a Christian with Santa Claus and fairy tales and all that, and you described that sort of as a false, not completely true version of Christianity. But is it possible that it's not just a coincidence, but that it's necessary, in fact, in order to raise religious human beings, to instill in them an ability to believe superstition and fairy tale, not just as pleasant bedtime stories, but as a description of the world?
It is absolutely necessary and a crucial function of education to subject
all claims to skeptical examination. In this, I include the claims of religion. I also include the claims of atheism. By the way, it's quite true that in earlier eras, the priest standing here would be a figure of authority. I would submit at Harvard that's not so much true anymore. It's the professor standing up here as a biologist and speaking in the name of science who carries that same canonical authority. And if he says that Darwin has shown that because creature A evolved into creature B, the idea of a creator has been rendered superfluous. Here is a man ultimately excavating metaphysics out of science, making a metaphysical, not a scientific statement, but smuggling it in with the authority of science. So this is what I see guys like Dennett, Pinker, and Dawkins doing. They're pretending to be scientific men, and they're giving you their anti-religious prejudices, which are carried in the sacred robes of science, which carries more authority today than if the Harvard chaplain said so. So skepticism all the way around.
Yep. Thank you very much, and thank you, John, for moderating the question as a portion of the debate. Now, finally, we're going to have a two-minute closing statements. Now, Dan started, right, so Dinesh, if you'd like to make your two-minute closing statement first.
There are really two possibilities. Either we are Darwinian primates, and that is all we are, or we are primates who are, you might say, in some sense, primates with a soul. Primates who have access to some transcendent source of morality, and perhaps some transcendent source for our very existence. If we are Darwinian primates, I would submit, this makes no sense of our everyday experience. For example, evolution would have programmed us to survive. It would not really have programmed us to understand the rotation of the planets. I don't imagine our antediluvian ancestors having to work that one out. We would have no reason to believe science is even true. We believe it's true because we believe our rationality is capable of apprehending the world. There's no Darwinian reason to think it is. Additionally, morality would make no sense. Dan Barker's core presupposition is we should try to avoid doing other people harm. Which other creature respects that law? There is none. Creatures routinely violate it. They kill each other. Look, if in the ape kingdom, if somebody walked into a house, grabbed a mate, subdued the other mate with blows, and dragged, if you will, the female of the species to his own camp to forcibly have sex with her, this is what we call the nature channel. We're not outraged about it. It's normal. That's nature. On the other hand, if Dan were to walk into my house, subdue me with blows, grab my wife, rape her, we would all be universally outraged. We would say that that is flat out wrong. By the way, not just wrong for him, wrong in general. Now, this morality is as real as any fact in the world. We are more sure about it than we are sure an external world exists. We are more sure of it than we are certain that we even lived yesterday. Something is harder to prove. This is a moral fact of the world. And I'm simply saying that, so you want proofs of God? There's one that is sitting within your head. And I want to answer this point about competing instincts. I'm walking on the riverbank. Yes, I have a survival instinct that says go on. Maybe I have a compassion instinct that says, as a fellow Homo sapiens, maybe I should be careful for their welfare. But C.S. Lewis says there's a third instinct that jumps in, that says, in effect, listen to instinct number two, not to instinct number one, that should by all accounts be stronger. We heard a rather macabre Machiavellian calculus by Dan about how, yeah, if it makes sense for me. I'll leave you with this thought. Mother Teresa on the streets of India was found by an Indian guy, and she was hugging a leper. And the Indian guy makes the rational point. He goes, I wouldn't do that for all the money in the world. And Mother Teresa said, you know what? I wouldn't either. I'm doing it for the love of Christ. In other words, it is this belief in transcendence that imbues in us a sense of our sacredness as human beings, the sacredness of others, even those who don't agree with us. Ultimately, what Christianity calls agape, which is to say unselfishness, caritas, this is something that would never exist in a Darwinian universe. It would be a darker, it would certainly be a bleaker place.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza.
Thank you all. This is really enjoyable. When Jesus talked about rendering unto Caesar, you got it wrong. This is not a call to secularism. These were two competing dictators. Caesar and God were both dictators. The people were not involved in a secular society. In America, we kicked out the dictator, the master, the Lord. We are a proudly rebellious nation. We say to Caesar and to God, render unto we the people the things that belong to we the people. I have an Indian story too. I'm an American Indian. My dad's a Delaware Indian from the Delaware River. And I'm a member of the tribe. And you know very well that before the European colonists got here, some of the native tribes were practicing a form of representative democracy long before the Europeans came over here with a gun in one hand and a Bible in the other. It did not stem from Christianity. Yes, we atheists do want religion out of the public square, but not out of the public sphere. If we call the public square the property that is owned by the public, the Capitol buildings and the principal's office, then the religion should be out of that, but not out of public discourse, not out of our public life as in the public sphere where we are all talking. I welcome you in the public sphere. I'm not trying to kick you out because you might be right and I might be wrong. We are not obnoxious and authoritarian about it. We invite discourse with other people. The universe, by the way, is not a thing. You're equivocating again. The universe, by definition, is all there is, or we could call it the cosmos. A thing is something in space-time. The universe cannot be called a thing. You're making a mistake of jumping up a logical sphere. When atheists and agnostics do good works, it's not for the love of Christ. That cheapens morality, to do it for the love of Christ. Goodness. We think we should be good for goodness sake. We are doing good for the love of humanity, which is a more authentic, a more relevant, a more real, a more ethical way to live our lives. Not because of the love of some dictator who needs his fragile vanity shored up with our praise to tell him how great he is. He's an inept parent if that's how he needs to get through his life. We think we should be good for goodness sake. Thank you all for coming. This was very enjoyable.
Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.